Five, four, three, two, one.
I know you're gonna dig this.
Welcome to the Barrett Sports Media Podcast.
Think we could listen to the radio or something?
Radio? Who needs a radio?
Featuring the biggest names and newsmakers from the world of sports media.
Don't act like you're not impressed.
Now, here's your host, the president of Barrett Sports Media, Jason Barrett.
Another week, another opportunity to chat with you about the ever-changing world of sports media. Nice to have you here. I'm Jason Barrett. Before I dive into this week's top story, I do want to ask a small favor. If you'd be so kind to take 1 minute out of your time to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes and leave a review, it helps me out a great deal. Honestly, the one thing I'm still getting a feel for is remembering to push that message. I haven't done it on the previous two episodes. I keep hearing from people, though, that reviews and subscribers contribute to a podcast climbing the ladder on the iTunes charts, and since the number of sports media podcasts aren't exactly large, I figure it only works and gains momentum if others help spread the word, so help me out if you don't mind. Another thing I want to point out, since I've received a few emails about it, is that I'm not presently accepting advertising on this podcast. To be honest with you, that may change in the future, but right now I want to keep the focus on creating great content and promoting it. If or when the time feels right to accept compensation on the show, I'll be sure to mention it here as well as on the website, sportsradiopd.com. Now, though, that we've gotten the business taken care of, let's get started with this week's starting point.
Quiet on the set. Can we please have quiet on the set?
Action! If you're not familiar with this story, I encourage you to visit my website and get familiar with it. KNBR and San Francisco have decided to eliminate on-air sports updates. As far as I'm concerned, I think it's a brilliant move and one that's long overdue. Quite honestly, I was surprised given KNBR's heritage in the market and their track record of being slow to respond to trends and the way the world changes. I don't know specifically how they arrived at this point as a management team, but I do know Bruce Gilbert and I know Jeremiah Crowe very well. And I'd be absolutely stunned if the two of them didn't have some type of involvement in pushing this move forward. Now, it's easy to stay the course and do what you've always done, especially when you're printing money the way KNBR does. But you also don't stay on top forever if you don't change with the times. There's a reason why the rotary phone, yellow pages, newspaper, and video stores are no longer relevant in our lives. People found ways to receive the same quality in a simpler fashion, and they simply outgrew the need for those services. The internet, social media, text alerts, now voice-on-demand technology such as the Amazon Alexa and Google Home have given people quicker access to information. Many sports stations also see their ratings decrease when an update airs because in the mind of the audience, it's an extension of a commercial break. When was the last time you watched a sports television program like NFL Live, Baseball Tonight, First Take, or Undisputed and wondered, when am I going to get an update on the latest sports news? It doesn't happen. People go there for the content, the drama, and the opinion. That's the draw, and it's no different on a sports radio show. They come to hear the host, the guests, the callers, reporters who break news, because they all provide the listener with entertainment value and information that they can later use in conversations with friends, family, and coworkers. Now, there are going to be a few people who don't agree with me on this subject. They'll use KNBR's decision as a sign of the radio apocalypse and mention it being another change for the worse for the industry. Or they'll mention how the move eliminates jobs and their good friends are now unemployed. They may even say that it's another example of radio stations looking to cut corners and be cheap. I strongly disagree. What this move should tell everyone in the sports radio industry is that you need to be creating value for yourself and occupying a position that is necessary to the radio station. The change in audience habits, the explosion of Twitter and Facebook, the commitment from teams and broadcast companies to be active and engaged digitally and socially, that's what's contributed to the listeners' access to information being better. As a result, it's caused radio stations to re-examine the value of on-air updates. A program director, market manager, and corporate executive are not doing their job if they're not consistently evaluating what they present on their stations, the way it's received by the audience, and making tough calls on whether or not certain things still offer value. And also, understand this. Moves like this have been happening slowly over the past few years. This is not just KBR. Some local stations have had their on-air hosts reading updates. Even ESPN Radio made that shift years ago when they put them in the hands of Mike and Mike. Others outsource updates or run them only in drive times, but not during middays when listening is traditionally lower. Some brands may even run a one-minute hourly report as they do in Seattle on 710 ESPN and brand them differently. In Seattle's case, they're called snapshots. I did the same exact thing years ago in St. Louis at 101 ESPN. We went from three updates per hour to one. I didn't eliminate any salary. I simply took my resources and repurposed them on the radio station in a smarter way. When I arrived in San Francisco and we were building 95.7 The Game, I kept updates in place because I was fortunate to have some incredible anchors who brought great entertainment value to the radio station. When you have people like Gianna Franco, Dan Dibley, and Drew Hoffer executing them, it makes you extend the leash, even though you know the value of the actual report isn't vital to the audience. They simply worked because each of those personalities were excellent at entertaining on the radio station. If I didn't have quality people like that, though, I'd have done exactly what KBR was doing. Thinking back, when I launched the game in San Francisco, I also did this in St. Louis at 101 ESPN. Both brands were built without traffic, weather, news, or stock reports. I remember being in conference rooms in both cities with people looking at me like I had two heads. We even branded against those things with a liner that said, "No traffic and weather together, we do sports." The strategy was simple. We wanted to put the focus on the on-air conversation, and each of those elements got in the way of it. I recognized that people were either using their phones or turning to a local news talk radio station for each of those elements, so we decided we'd be better off creating our own lane, not adding things to our product that got in the way of what we did best. And if I had to do it over tomorrow, I'd do the same exact thing, except updates would also be in the conversation. I don't like to see anyone lose a job. When situations like this occur, the first thing a radio station has to determine is, can this person help us in a different way? If you can report and break news, if you can host, if you can produce, or if you became a columnist or video star on the radio station's website, each of those roles provide value. That's really what this comes down to. Does the position have value? And if it doesn't, you cannot get mad at the radio station for changing with the times, because if they don't, and the audience does, ultimately they pay a steep price for it. If you agree or disagree, you can always reach me on Twitter at SportsRadioPD, or you could also email me at jbarrett@sportsradiopd.com. It's now time for my weekly chat with a member of the sports media industry. This week, I have the good fortune of connecting with Chris Domino of 680 The Fan in Atlanta. Chris has spent his entire career in the same market, although for a brief amount of time, he hosted a show in St. Louis remotely. I had an opportunity to catch up with him and explore the highs, lows, and in-betweens of his radio career, and I think you're going to enjoy that conversation.
And now, our feature presentation.
All right, Chris, so you've been in the business now for over two decades, but your start was a little less than conventional, to say the least. So for those who are listening and unaware, tell them how you got your actual start in sports radio.
Yeah, this is really bad when one of the local broadcast schools asks you if you'd like to be a speaker, and then you have to tell them, yeah, I'm probably the last person to stand in front of people who are paying tuition, whether it's at a college or at a broadcast school. I was a caller originally here in Atlanta. When I first moved down here, I don't know, I had way too much time in a car because of Atlanta traffic going back and forth to chiropractic school. And Scott Farrell was on here in Atlanta, local live. And I just remember on a Friday afternoon randomly calling him one day. And we exchanged a little bit beyond pleasantries, but not much. And every couple of weeks when I was stuck in traffic, I'd just give a random call in. And finally, after a few phone calls, I think at one point I sort of hung up on him. I said, we're not at a point in a relationship where you should be asking me any questions. And just goofing around, I hung up. And I think his producer thought that was pretty funny. So a few weeks later when I called, there was a guy by the name of Mike Thompson, who a lot of people on radio will know. He had moved down to Atlanta, and he said, I'm looking for something, I don't know what it is. And Scott Farrell's producer, Robert Wolf, said, there's a guy that calls up every once in a while. I have no idea what his name is. Scott calls him Jersey, but I think it might be what you're talking about. And literally the next time I called in a few weeks later, they put me on hold. I met up with them on a Thursday afternoon. I was on the air Sunday night with four other guys. And on Tuesday of that next week, Mike Thompson himself called me and said, look, I was a little worried that first hour. He said, but the last two, it was a bartender mentality. And I told him that's exactly what I was in New Jersey when I went back to school. And he said, well, that's the guy that I think I'd like to hire. And lo and behold, in the top 10 market, I'm doing afternoon drive while going to chiropractic school at the same time.
What year is this and how old are you at the time?
It's 1993, so I'm 30 years old. I just moved down here. And the crazy part is the guy who was hosting that show, I think he thought the job, whatever job it was his. And about an hour in, I promise you, there's a couple of guys to his right, and I'm the only guy to his left, and he started to turn his back on me. And I remember we went to a break about an hour in, and I just said, look, with all due respect, I don't know who you are, and you certainly don't know who I am, but I think you're trying too hard, and you're going to pay a little bit of a price from here on out. And as he started to turn his chair to me in the next 2 hours, it just kept sort of mouthing to him, it's too late, it's too late. And I was just having fun with it. I had no idea there was a job. I had no idea what this was. It seems that a couple other guys in the room did. And that's when Mike Thompson came up with that first hour. I was a little nervous, but the second 2 hours was sort of what he had heard from this producer, Robert Wolf, about the phone calls with Scott and I. And it was so crazy because Scott literally called me Jersey because that was the only thing he knew me as. And we laugh to this day whenever I appear on his show. I've given him credit to anybody who wants to listen. There have been other people in the industry who have gone to Syracuse and all these other colleges from communication majors. And when they hear this kind of story, especially in the top 10 market, they sort of can't believe how it all happened. It was the advent of sports talk radio down here, and the format had only been about 6 or 7 years old at that point. So it was really crazy how this many years later, still in the same markets, which you know better than anybody, really doesn't happen, that it was an original phone call on Highway 285, Route 285 in Atlanta that got the whole thing started.
Now, you're probably making at this point, what, $7.50 an hour?
I joked with Mike Thompson. I said, I think you paid me. I said, I'm almost positive you paid me at that point. He said, no, I paid you. He said, but look, at that point, nobody really knew what the wage was supposed to be. I mean, sports talk radio in Atlanta was months old at that point. I'm not kidding. It was months old as a full-time thing down here. But it was, I'll tell you what it was. It was enough where I didn't have to take out student loans. I had money sort of to live on, which was fantastic because it was either that or get another bartender job down here. So it really worked. And look, you, me, and everybody who's ever done this, the thing that I thought I was getting paid in more than anything else, I was having a good time. But I had always been the guy that when I could go to games, I was sitting 3 rows from the top. And I promise you, Jason, the first time a couple of my buddies from New Jersey came down to visit me, I took them to a Hawks game, and instead of turning right to go up, we turned left to go down. And we sat right, this is the God's honest truth, we sat right behind Pat Riley, who was coaching the Knicks at the time. I mean, right behind the bench, and those were, quote-unquote, my seats. And to this day, 8 times a year, I get a media credential. And I joke with my kids, I said, you know, you get Christmas, you get a bike, you get whatever it is. My Christmas comes every time I get a credential. And 23 years later, I honestly still feel that way, that that's meeting interesting people is still the best part of it. But the idea that you can get into this many buildings and this many events, and not just locally across the country, it's an unbelievable thing for like a lot of us who just said, boy, if I can only go to more games, I would really do it.
After you get your feet wet and start to gain some local momentum, it's not long before 790 The Zone is launched. Eventually, they pluck you away. You go on to have a great run there. But for those listening who may not be familiar with The Zone since it doesn't exist any longer, how would you describe the early days at that radio station?
All right, let me just give you the quick one. They didn't pluck me away. Here's what's crazy. I actually came up with the name The Zone. Steak Shapiro and I were at a Georgia Tech basketball game, and he was telling me about how he was going to start the station. I was working for 680 The Fan, the station I now work for again, but they were under release management. I got fired, I think that's the right word, in the newspaper on a Friday. And it's an August day I'll never forget it. A guy calls up and says, "Hey, man, how you doing?" I was like, "I'm perfect. Braves are in town. Weather's going to be fantastic this weekend. How are you doing?" He goes, no. He said, "I'm sorry to hear about what happened." I'm like, "What happened?" There used to be two editions of the Atlanta paper, the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. I was in the studio really early. I was doing morning drive, and I had read the newspaper. But the final edition came out, and right at, on the front page of the sports section, 6A to the Fan drop-in format. I was basically fired in the newspaper.
Wow.
I mean, on air at 7:15, I found out about it, 7:30 or so. So that was the crazy part. I had just re-upped my contract with them, so I wasn't going to be able to go to the zone. Well, lo and behold, I'm a street free agent at that point. And there was a guy by the name of Nick Trigoni who worked. He was a very big guy at Cox Broadcasting, who they had me under a non-compete, and they could have done things with me and held me back. But I give him credit. He allowed me to go to work for 790 The Zone. And if you're really asking what that was about, it was the wild, wild west. We were a single-owned radio station. We had no idea about the rules. We had no idea about corporate anything. We survived trading for restaurant gift cards. We would eat lunch and dinner at some of the restaurants that were quote-unquote sponsors of the radio station to start out. And we were just dumb enough not to know what we should be doing. We were smart enough and dumb enough to figure out we were going to knock on all the doors of the corporate guys here in Atlanta who we thought or we knew were listening, and we'd hope some of them were decision-makers who had control of some bucks who could actually get this thing not only off the ground, but get it actually a viable radio station.
One thing you can say about The Zone that can never be taken away from it is that it played a key role in the careers of many great talents. For example, the two live stews, Chuck Oliver and Matt Chernoff, who now do afternoons on your station, 680. Former players David Pollock, Dennis Scott, Chuck Smith all spent time there on the air. Even Fox Sports radio programmer Scott Shapiro and Doug Gottlieb's producer Adam Klug spent time working at the station. So clearly, it made an impact on many individuals. While you were there, you hosted middays and afternoons, but the show that generated the most noise on the station, which you were also a part of, was the morning show, Mayhem in the AM. The show featured Steak Shapiro, Mike Bell, yourself, and your 680 morning show teammate Nick Cellini. Why did that show become such a hit?
I think what it was it was sort of the bar mentality. Mike Thompson told me, I'm telling you, he said, the minute you forget that you were a bartender, I'll fire you. And I just think it was an extension of the study hall conversation to the bar conversation when you got older, the college Nintendo Tecmo, you know, you lose, you got to sit out, let's get some pizza and play and work hard, play hard, no doubt about it. And I'm telling you this, we shook a lot of hands, we kissed a lot of babies. There was no doubt about it that we worked hard, but I'd be hard-pressed to believe there was a radio station that knew that your shift wasn't the time you were on air. This was a quote-unquote full-time job, but it was the best full-time job ever. We would go to games. We would go to events. We would watch games with clients or potential clients, in part because we knew it was survival. But more than that, I really believe that there were enough guys who wanted to have a beer with us. And believe me, we had beers all over Atlanta. Nick Cellini and I did a show during middays that we were at a bar in Buckhead. We would have people come out. It was a live show, and people would watch. But we would order drinks and drink them on the air. You wouldn't get out the order before you were fired today. And I'm not telling you there doesn't need to be some regulation, but we didn't know any better. And I think it served us really well that if you wanted to go have a conversation with guys that you thought it might be fun to go to a game with, play around the golf with, quite honestly, it's sometimes socialize with, not too much because you'd lose your family if you're an amateur at the whole thing. But I just thought that that was the pervasive feeling when we all got together and it was working as well as it could.
So it's around this time, the good times are rolling in Atlanta. The station is generating a ton of revenue. Management decides they're going to roll the dice and expand the brand by purchasing a radio station in St. Louis. That would become 590 The Fan KFNS. I sign on in June 2006 to program it. A few months later, you come on board after a good friend of ours, longtime market veteran Mike Claiborne, left to join the St. Louis Cardinals radio broadcast. That meant that on a daily basis at one time, you were part of a four-hour morning show in Atlanta, a two-hour midday show in St. Louis, plus you were hosting the Zone's Atlanta Braves pregame show, Hardball. How do you even stay sharp when you're on the air for 7 hours a day?
I still get my balls busted about that, and I'm telling you, I never thought it was problematic until somebody brought it up. look, here's the thing. It was diverse enough day-to-day with the one show. It was diverse enough day-to-day with St. Louis, and I was trying to learn the market, and I think I had the right approach because I never came in there with red-colored pom-poms claiming to be a fan of anybody. I just wanted to do a show. The Braves Hardball was a counter to the actual Braves pregame show, which really became one of my favorite things to do ever, because really what we turned it into, Matt Edgar, the producer originally, I think we did a half hour, then we turned it into an hour. I had an opportunity to speak to 50-plus living baseball Hall of Famers and a whole bunch of other people whose names you would know or stories you maybe knew, and we had a chance to ferret it out. I just loved the conversation part of it. So I never thought about it as hours on the air or being burned out. Whether it was the, it could be worse, I could be wearing a tie. It could be worse, I certainly could be in a ditch. And it was really sort of that six-hour shift of a bartender who just said, what do we got? Oh, you're a Knicks fan. Oh, you're a fill-in-the-blank, whatever it might be. And then you just had different conversations with different people, and every day, because the headlines were going to be different or the possible headlines were going to be different, I never thought of it that way. And I promise you, other people have brought it out, but I never thought about it being the amount of hours on the air is supposed to matter. It's just, can you actually, as you said, keep your energy up and find something fairly interesting to try to connect and make it relatable to anybody and everybody who might be listening.
We both know guys who were talented yet for one reason or another struggled to make a connection when entering a new market. It's especially hard when you're facing that challenge in a provincial town like St. Louis. Yet in your case, Chris, you managed to strike a chord with the audience and you didn't even live there. Why do you think you were so well received?
Yeah, I think part of it was I was really honest. I wasn't going to come in saying that I knew a lot about the town. I knew nothing about the town. I wasn't going to come in and say, hey, you know who my favorite player of all time was? Fill in the blank with anybody from Sam Usual to Lou Brock to whatever direction I could have gone. I knew a couple of guys on the Rams, which sort of helped. I knew hockey. I grew up around hockey. We'd had it here in Atlanta and lost it multiple of times. So I enjoyed the game. I think that came across as well. But I didn't know the St. Louis Blues, but I didn't claim to. I'm going to tell you the best thing that ever happened to me. It actually has formed some relationships that I still have today. I came on in 2006, in September of 2006. And anybody who knows, that's the year the Cardinals won a World Series. Well, I came on in September. That was the 83-win team that won a World Series. Very unexpected. But I had a couple of really interesting things happen. During the postseason, I had a chance to do those postgame press conferences or pregame press conferences with Tony La Russa. And at one point, early in October, and I'm on the air for a few weeks, he actually asked me my name during a press conference and said that was a good question or something. And we engaged in a little bit of back and forth, which I guess didn't happen very often, or, you know, it certainly didn't happen very often with me. Well, La Russa comes on the station, KFNS, with me, and he sort of gives me a blessing. A couple of months in, Bob Costas comes on, gives me the blessing. Now, all of a sudden, whatever, you know, it's the made man thing. When you're an Italian, you know what that means. I got guys in St. Louis making me a made man fairly early into this whole thing. And at that point, I think people realized he's not here to claim territory. He's not here to know me. And at the end of the day, I think he does what it is we like to do, having respect for the past, the history of it, looking forward to the future and the possibility of it. And being there for that postseason run, I think people could tell that I was thoroughly overjoyed that I was on in Shea Stadium when they beat the Mets. I was there for the World Series clinch in St. Louis. It was just a confluence of events that really sort of helped me along. And as I said, those are relationships that I have to this day. Those guys did me a really good solid, but they turned around and said, look, the way you handled yourself coming into a market like this, you put yourself in pretty good ground. I think it would just sort of should have been acknowledged and a couple of the right guys did it.
So to someone in the business who's moving to a new city tomorrow or considering it for the first time, or even to a program director who's going through the process and considering hiring an out-of-market talent but is nervous about pulling the trigger, what advice would you pass along from your experience that you feel would be helpful to them in that situation?
Yeah, you know, I think people can smell fear, but I think they can also smell BS. I think what's probably happening in a bunch of towns is you go in, and in the first couple of days on the air, you blow your load with the history of that town. Look at me. I know everything about the Kansas City Royals. Look at me. I know everything about the San Francisco Giants or 49ers. And I think people smell that. You know, it's not about reading it in a book. I think today's sports talk listener is way too savvy for that. While at its core, it's still that bar conversation. People have too much. They hear enough of it now. They hear it amongst their friends. Who hasn't been around a guy who you thought, oh, he's trying too hard?
Yep.
He's trying to convince me that he knows this when really what he knows is the facts, but he doesn't have a feel for it. If you're going into a new town claiming you have a feel for how that city has experienced the highs, or the lowest of lows. You don't. You can try to relate your experiences, but I promise you, you don't know theirs. And to me, the first thing would be is get people around you who can fill you in a little at a time as to what matters. I mean, I know before you walk in the door, you should have an understanding, and you know this better than anybody. What's the pecking order? What rates the highest? What do people care about the most? But that's just a list. Then you got to figure out day to day, how can you incorporate yourself into those conversations without it being, hey, watch this. I happen to know what happened in Game 3 of the World Series in 1968. Well, you read it in a book. It's not the same as you living it with us, so don't try to tell me that it is. Do you know the other thing that helped me in St. Louis? And I think, you know, from a baseball point of view, if people sort of consider you as a guy who knows baseball or a guy who knows football, contacts are great. I'm able to get guys on the phone. But you know me, I really love, and it's one of the things that I don't like about terrestrial radio, you know, long-form interviews. It's impossible to do long-form interviews in local radio. It just is. You can't do it. You can't get a feel for the whole story. You certainly have to look at the clock. You and everybody know that better than I do. I don't really care about the clock. It's just time. Until somebody's cut your mic off and says, we have to run commercials here, or you have to understand what it is we're doing and how the ratings game works. I've never really cared much about that. I understand it better now. But up in St. Louis, and I think in other markets, if you have some contacts who can get people on and let them tell their story, that helps. Respect the people that they care about is a really, that's another thing you probably want to have on your checklist if you are going to move to a different town.
So you're on the air in two markets. You're also doing some local TV in Atlanta at the time. And then all of a sudden, the wheels start to slowly come off. The St. Louis show goes away as Andrew and Stake are feeling the pressure of overpaying for the radio station. Soon thereafter, Lincoln Financial takes control of 790 The Zone. How did the station change when Stake and Andrew were no longer in full control?
It's more corporate at that point. And I'm not telling you it wasn't supposed to be because the corporation owned it. And, you know, one of the things that happens is I've always thought that one of the great things you can do in radio, one of the great things about this format is you can rail against the man. You know, there are guys who wear suits who don't understand what it is we do as we do this every day. But then all of a sudden there really were people in suits. I used to be able to tell the people who didn't wear suits, my bosses, Stake, Andrew, and other guys, ah, look at them, they're the suits. Well, they were never really suits, but it just sort of sounded good because they were the bosses.
Mm-hmm.
You know, 99% of the world thinks they're smarter than their boss. Take advantage of that. It's really relatable. But then all of a sudden you do have real corporate people in, and all of a sudden, whether it's bean counting or one of the other things that corporate people do, they're beholden to somebody else. I'm not dumb. I get it. It just can mean it's not quite as much fun as it used to be at that point.
Despite that change, you're still doing your thing in mornings. All of a sudden, you're faced with the biggest career-changing moment you've ever gone through. During a break, you, Stake, and Cellini are kicking around some ideas. It leads to a skit gone terribly wrong. Cellini calls into the show from a phone in the other room as a character with ALS, mocking former Saints player Steve Gleason, who has the disease. All of a sudden, you've just put in 15-plus years in the business. You've kept your nose clean, done everything the right way, but it's all gone in an instant. The three of you guys are fired. How would you describe that morning and what took place during the break and on the air?
It's horrible, and you can't run from it. You don't hide from it. You know, my kids were a little bit too young to totally understand it, except Dad didn't work all of a sudden. And look, I've come to the conclusion that really what it is, it's not only horrible, it wasn't funny, but it was also bullying. As a father of daughters, it's the one thing other than their health that I worry about the most. Are people mean? And it was mean. It's almost 20 years of never having a problem, which I think served me well coming out of the back end of it. But yeah, it was beyond devastating. At that point, you're getting a call later on the same day in the afternoon saying, okay, it's done.
Well, yeah, considering that you had a hand in naming the radio station, helped build it from the ground up with Stake, Andrew, and many others, watched it grow from being a brand which was barely hanging on by a thread to becoming a force in the market, and after making that personal investment in the station and pouring years of your hard work, love, and care into it, in the blink of an eye, it's all gone.
I'm going to be honest with you. I'm still a little goofed up to this day about it. You know, you try to make amends and you reach out to the people that you know you have to reach out to at that point, the people that you thoroughly have disappointed, not just in the industry. Believe me, it went a lot further than that. I did a couple of things behind the scenes that I don't necessarily need to talk about now that I think helped me, not professionally, because I was still without a job, but it helped me personally. And I'll just tell you this, that the Gleason family themselves were unbelievable to me, and the people around Steve Gleason were unbelievable to me. And that certainly helped, you realize at that point, what are you and what are you not? Well, if you spent, you know, that many years of your life trying to be a decent human being and all of a sudden you weren't and you pay the price, well, what are you going to get out of it coming out of the other end? You know, I wasn't sure. You and I talked. I wasn't sure if this market was going to work or if I necessarily wanted a clean break, a clean start, or what was going to happen. I will also say this, that one of the things that helped me, and I think it was from a couple of program directors and a couple of people in this town, the teams, the colleges, the major schools, sort of came forward pretty quickly and said, we don't have a problem with him. It's the same thing you try to teach your kids. You're going to get kicked in the teeth. You're going to do it to yourself. You're going to stand on the train track. And by the way, you did it and you're standing there. And there's a reason the train hit you is because you put yourself in that situation. But I think the moments before an awful incident like that will help determine what happens after the fact. And I think that's what happened. Not only David Dickey, my current boss here, but again, the teams and the people who ran those teams, if there's such a thing as vouching or putting in a good word, you know, it's the least proud moment of my life. I'm not lying when I say I'm still a little goofed up about it because it's just, it hangs over you. It doesn't go away. I'm not even trying to pretend that it's gone away. I think, as a matter of fact, it's a good thing it hasn't, because hopefully it's been a lesson to other people, not only in this industry, but whether it's Facebook or social media, there's no such thing as delete. You know, you don't get a lot of adult do-overs. I think the nicest thing that somebody said to me was, if you do that many hours of live radio without blanking up, you're going to blank up. You know, and I think that sort of has helped. And you and I had that conversation on a couple of occasions. I just think that if you're the guy the program directors or teams, or quite honestly, your family has to worry about that the 3 a.m. phone call is coming because it's happened a few different times, you'd like to think that your worst moment is truly going to be your worst moment. And in my mind, you know, again, short of the health of my kids and my family, the worst moment I've experienced, certainly professionally, was that one. And I was in the room. And guilty as charged, and it doesn't matter necessarily trying to figure out how or why at that point. It's just, what are you going to do about it? And again, if you do the right thing, you know, the lesson that you also want to be able to teach your kids or anybody else that's important to you is, if you've done the right thing and you do the right thing after a moment like that, there is an opportunity to have things turn out better. And especially when people like the Gleason family and people in the ALS Association here in Atlanta really, really helped me out. Not because I went around saying, look what I'm going to do for you, I'm going to raise money. They helped me out because they said, what can we do to turn this into a positive? They asked me. And then all of a sudden there was an opportunity to turn it into a positive for other people, which not only helps ease your own pain, but you certainly realize at a certain point, if you allow yourself, that some good has actually come out of it. And by the way, that's a true story. Somebody with the ALS Association here said it's the greatest bad moment that's ever happened to us because of the national awareness at that point.
One of my favorite quotes is, adversity causes some to break, others to break records. And obviously everyone goes through life and has an unfortunate situation or two pop up on their radar, and it's how you deal with it that decides whether or not you take steps in the right direction afterwards when you go through a tough time.
Yeah, but I was broken.
Oh, yeah, no question. I remember you and I had many conversations about it, and how could you not be? You're on CNN, you're on ESPN, everybody's paying attention. What I wanted to ask you is, if someone tomorrow in our business went through a situation, which hopefully they never do, but if they did, that was similar to yours, what would you advise them to do during that kind of moment?
Look, I'm going to be really honest. I don't know if they allow as much leeway the second and third time. I don't know for sure. I hope nobody has to find out, because I certainly don't want anybody, not just to put themselves in that situation, but all of a sudden to cause pain. You know, the other part of that is you caused a lot of people pain, not just your own family, certainly, but people who, you know, or who are dealing with it, or people, you know, 1 degree, 2 degrees removed from whatever it might be, ALS or anything else. So I don't think you want to put yourself in that situation. I will go back to what we said about St. Louis, though. If you try to phony your way through it, I think you're going to set up more problems than not. I do. I just think you got to figure out, just who are you? Why did it happen? If you're instantaneously looking for the, okay, let me fix this, which is the norm, go find the scramble mode, I think at that point you're more than likely to make another mistake. You're more than likely to do something that you don't feel good about somewhere down the road, as opposed to actually trying to figure out what it is you need to do. I mean, what would be my advice? I know the initial reaction is, I got to fix it. Well, there was no quick fix. And if there's no quick fix, I promise you, there's a chance you could actually make it worse.
So after that career low point, you stayed low for a while. A few months later, you were given a chance to redeem yourself. 680 The Fan hires you. But at that time, you talked about people vouching for you, and certainly people did. You also apologized publicly and on social media, which I thought was outstanding, and a lot of people really respected you for the way you came across sincere and genuine with what you presented. But at that time, in addition to 680 The Fan, 92.9 The Game was also interested. You ultimately chose to return to your roots, 680. Just curious why you chose at that time to go with 680 following the challenge you just went through as opposed to a new start with CBS.
I think it was probably the existing relationship with David Dickey, the guy who owns the radio station. I think part of it was Braves baseball. Look, I'm not lying about this. You and I had multiple conversations. I had conversations with other markets. I think the baseball part of it, I certainly had gone to more Braves games than most people. I certainly appreciated a lot of, you know, personal friends and franchise relationships that I had, and 680 was a flagship. I think one of the things that happened is it was certainly, you know, a conversation I had with my wife, a conversation I had with myself. But at the end of the day, I thought that the baseball angle, the baseball part of it, was something I definitely wanted to be involved in, and it was afforded at 680, and at that point it wasn't at 92.9, and I knew some of the people over there. A couple of people, look, there's a couple of people over there that I have great respect for. One of the top guys, Rick Caffey. He was an extremely good radio friend at that point to me, but it was sort of a comfort factor. And, you know, my wife and I looked around, and I don't know why people choose to leave markets. It's for a number of reasons. I've never really aspired, or I've never really put my name out there to say, well, I'd like to be over there, and then I'd like to be over there in 2 years. I liked it here. You know, I liked the ability to say that my kids were going to be raised here. I think that was a big part of staying in town initially. But I think there was comfortability, you know, comfortability factor with David and the station, and certainly having a history. It's kind of crazy that it's 20 years later, you kind of go full circle to be working with the same sort of logo on your golf shirt that you did when you first started out.
Yeah, except now you're not Jersey, you're Chris Domino.
Yeah, that's true.
Okay, so you make the decision to sign with 680. Initially on a part-time basis, since you have to wait out a non-compete from your deal with The Zone. When that expires, you're thrust into mornings alongside Chris Root and Perry Laurentino on The Root Awakening. These guys, though, had been competing against you for years while you were at The Zone, and let's be honest, you're joining the show fresh off of the lowest moment of your broadcast career, one which earned you a lot of national attention for the wrong reasons. I'm guessing that couldn't have made it easy for everyone involved who was working on a new professional relationship and on-air partnership.
Yeah, but I think the one good thing is that everybody in radio has probably had, if you do this long enough, I mean, you know better. You're trying to figure out who you should pair up and why and what might work. And are there crapshoots? Sure. Are there things that work and things that don't? Absolutely. The market, the format is littered with things that have worked and things that didn't work. So I think the one thing is, when you've dealt with somebody across the street, when you've, you know, dealt with somebody, the competition, who's been trying to take money out of your pocket, I mean, for lack of a better term, that's really what it is. It's food off your plate. I think you're certainly going to have that moment of, if not stink eye, you're going to try to figure out what the hell's going on around here and how are we going to pull this off. So I don't think that part was any different than any other time it's happened in any other market. The circumstance certainly was different. I'm not downplaying that. But I think at the end of the day, everybody's trying to figure out, how do you make a show? What's everybody's role? And that's, you know, sometimes it happens a little bit more comfortably than others. But that's not new. You know, ever since they flipped the switch on and said, look, sports talk is now a real thing and we're going to do it for hours a day, then it becomes live and local all day long. Guys like you and program directors, and I grew up on the format. I grew up on listening to games and listening to broadcast teams that I thought were good or had good chemistry. That part's not unusual. I just think at a certain point, what concessions are you willing to make? What things do you actually get a chance to shine at? And what, you know, how many times do you sort of pull back and go, well, that's not my world, that's their world, let them do it, or let him do it. Depends upon how many people are in the room.
You're right. Everybody likes to add this, subtract that. Ultimately, 680 makes the decision to part ways with Perry. They bring in your former partner, Nick Cellini, to work with Root and yourself. Steak Shapiro at this time is hosting middays on the station with Brian Finneran and Sandra Golden, which means the entire Zone morning show is now reunited under the same roof, although working for a different ownership group and on different shows. I've got to believe conversations had to take place at some point about putting the band back together.
You know, I don't know. I certainly wasn't a part of it. If there was, I'm sort of like everybody else now, sort of do as you're told. If anybody asks my opinion, I'm certainly willing to give it, but I wasn't asked my opinion on that. So, look, Nick Cellini is the little brother I never wanted. I've been using that line forever. We joke about it on the air as much as we possibly can. We can finish these other sentences. There's a, I'm going to set you up. You hit it out of the park. You're going to set me up. I'm going to hit it out of the park. I think Chris Root is now certainly a part of that as well, where you go, strength, you take this one. This one's yours. It is interesting to realize that, you know, everybody sort of is working at this radio station in the same market. What works, what doesn't. I say all the time, if you're a discernible listener, give us a chance. My line has always been, what's the page eight story that eventually is going to make its way towards page one? There are guys who are better in this job at finding out what will be a talking point and then turning it into a storyline. Look, you and I have had many conversations, and I've talked to other people I respect. I root for storylines. I'm still a fan. I wear that part on my sleeve. I don't root for the teams that I rooted for growing up in New York and New Jersey anymore. My kids don't care about that. I was not going to glory days them. We're an Atlanta family. We root for Atlanta teams. I certainly know how you can move to another market and either keep your allegiances or not. But in our world, program directors, I think, are supposed to be thinking about who are the guys that are relatable and can tell a story, or find the story and then find a way to tell it interestingly, find out whether there's a guest or whether it's just going to stay in a room amongst the hosts. If you have a good sense of that, what's the storyline here? How is it relatable? I've always said, don't tell anybody about you getting a free round of golf. That's not relatable. Talk about how lousy you are at golf. That is. And I think those are the types of things that as hosts you have to be sort of in tune with. That sort of is something that all of us can do. And the best guys around the country, I think, certainly are the guys who can say, what is the storyline today? It's not the final score. Hell, you know this better than anybody. Final scores are the most irrelevant thing in sports talk right now. People have those in their hands the minute the games are done. Hell, they have them in their hands while games are going on. It's the storyline of the game, and then bigger picture beyond that. If you can figure that stuff out, you have an opportunity to probably present more interesting material.
In a minute, I've got a few quick hitters I want to fire in your direction. But first, I'd kick myself if I forgot to ask you about your policy of not accepting an interview with conditions. Now, this actually came into play in Atlanta once when you had O.J. Simpson on your show. It became a discussion that generated a lot of local attention. If you would, explain to the listening audience how that situation with Simpson came about and why you take this approach when lining up interviews on your shows.
Yeah, so just real quick, I've also said a couple of things. I don't want to do a Q&A. Q&A, if you have a legal issue and you need to know things finitely, if there's things, facts that you have to know, there may be some interviews with Q&As, but I've always thought it's supposed to be a conversation. I've never written down a question. I've done homework. I've done a preview. I've sort of tried to know who it is you're going to be talking to, obviously. But I've always thought if you wrote down seven questions, you're asking number four because it's the one after three, but you didn't really listen to any answers. So that all sort of ties into this. I think if you do an interview with a condition, I'll let you do the interview, except you can't ask about this. I've just said, no, it doesn't do me any good. You know, George Brett, I did a half hour with him on that hardball show you talked about. And at the end, he said, hey, I just want to thank you. And I said, well, hold on. I was getting ready to thank you. And what he said is, no, let me thank you. No hemorrhoids, no pine tar. And I knew what he meant. And it was really interesting. Like, he respected, maybe that was supposed to be an 8-minute interview that turned into 32 minutes. Because, you know, my whole thing is there are two things that you want when you do one of these conversations. You want somebody to lean into the microphone, the guy you're talking to lean into his phone because he's excited to tell you something. But you also want him to pull back and sit back in the chair because he's relaxed. That's what I go back to where the long-form interviews is a dead art in local radio because you don't get that lean-in moment. You don't get that sit-back moment because there's not enough time. And these guys are more programmed than ever before to give you bull-dorm answers. The OJ, you know, we mentioned a guy by the name of Matt Edgar. We did a Heisman Trophy series. I think we spoke to like 35 or 38 living Heisman Trophy winners, and obviously OJ is one of them. So we found out that OJ was willing to do the interview, and I said, well, hold on. Heisman Trophy, one thing. I said, but, you know, we got an interview. He was living down in Florida at the time. I said, if this is off the table, then I don't want to do it. I don't really care much about anything else other than this conversation. I promise you, we did about 40 minutes with him, maybe 45, and halfway through, we thought he hung up on us. I said, well, there it is. It's over. And I said, I believe he cut two people's heads off.
Wow.
He started to tell, well, if that's the case, why do people think I'm a small guy, and why do people let their kids come play with my kids in my house? I said, I can't give you the answers to that, but I'll tell you just a follow-up. It was interesting. He was on another show on the station a little bit further down the road, maybe a year later, year and a half later, And he was more upset with the fact that I said his pro career was overrated, and I did say that at one point. It was brought up to him. He was more upset with that than me saying he murdered two people. I want you to think about that. He was actually more upset about the fact that I said, if you really look at his pro career, it's three great seasons, and it's a few other seasons. And look, he made himself a Hall of Famer. His college career was much better than his pro career. So I'll give you one more. John Feinstein, you know, very well-respected author, he was supposed to be on that day with us. Well, we go really long with OJ, and then we're getting follow-up phone calls and every conversation that comes with it. Well, Feinstein then comes around and says, he said, well, I'll never do that show again. You pandered to OJ Simpson without even hearing what was said. And I called John back. I said, you're so off on this one. I said, by the way, it's fine. I said, but you work for a network. He was working for ESPN at the time. That OJ was the front story every night. I said, John, who you worked with, the way they handled it was not only no better than what we just did, we were a hell of a lot more honest than people who were reading teleprompters. It's like we had Pete Rose on before he admitted to gambling. And I said to Pete, Pete, of course you gambled on baseball. He said, well, why do you believe that? I said, because gamblers bet on what they think they know the best. Why the heck would you bet, you know, animals? You're betting on horses and dogs. So I know gamblers. I swear to you, I've been one. I know them. I've been around them my whole life. Gamblers gamble on the thing that think they know the best. And now, Pete, credit, because this is pre-admitting anything. He said, that's the best theory I've heard as to why I bet on baseball. Now, he wasn't going to give it up at that point. He wasn't ready, or it wasn't conducive to him saying it then. But I just think that if you're more honest than those, you know, non-conditional interviews, or if you're more honest, look, I have a line. If I said it about you, I'd have to say it to you. If you hang up or tell me the interview doesn't happen, you hang up during the interview. We got hung up on by Mills Lane, Bob Knight, Tom Osborne. I've been hung up by Hall of Famers. I'm not worried about that. My job wasn't to insult you.
Now, do you have a wall for these guys? Like anytime you get hung up on, a new face goes up on it?
It's funny. I can name about the 8 or 9 guys who flat out hung up on us. Jesse Jackson hung up on us. He called us chumpy one day. And I'm not wearing them like a badge of honor, but I am telling you that if you've never had a team angry with you in the town you work in, if you've never had or been called to the principal's office, you haven't done your job thoroughly. If you've never been, if not hung up on, had people upset with you. But I've always thought the way that you keep them from being upset is, here's what I said about you, now let's talk. You play that card at the top of the deck, not the bottom. I'm not impressed if you do 10 minutes with somebody and then say, well, let me tell you what I've said about you. Tell them what you said about them to start, and then find out where it can go from there. Not only might it be more interesting, but at least you're being honest at that point.
Fair points. All right, I want to close this out with a couple of quick hits.
Yeah.
Just the first thing that jumps to your mind over the... I'm going to hit you with 5 questions, okay?
Okay.
One trait that all great sports radio hosts must have is...
Relatability.
Atlanta sports radio stations and shows don't earn a lot of national recognition because...
Boy, I hate to throw this on the teams, but the teams might not win enough.
A great program director finds a way to consistently blank his or her talent.
Tutor, but also foot in the rear end when it's supposed to happen, pat on the back when it's supposed to happen.
After years of local success, the two live stews not earning another local shot in Atlanta full-time means...
I'm as surprised as anybody that it didn't happen, so I might not be the guy that gives you a proper answer, because I'm surprised it didn't happen.
All right, and the final one, I'm going to put you on the spot here. Chris D'Amino still secretly craves having an opportunity to host a national sports radio program, even if it meant hosting one time per week at night or on the weekend.
I would love to, because it just opens up more of those stories that I just talked about. There are national things that we don't talk about, and locally, that happens in just about every market. The ability to expand to have a national perspective and a national caller on some of those stories, I, like a lot of people, would like to have an opportunity to expand the conversations, not narrow it down.
All right, so Steve Cohen, Scott Shapiro, Justin Craig Larson, I hope you're paying attention. The man would like to do some extra work.
I don't want to sound like I'm on a street corner with a cup in my hand, but yes, if the possibility did exist and you were looking for somebody who has a really strong interest in expansion as opposed to contraction of storylines, yeah, if nominated, I will run. If elected, I will serve.
And we already know you've already been willing to start a career working for free, so that already makes you an attractive commodity.
That's the part you're not supposed to talk about. And I'm just going to say this. Good for you for doing this and having guys on, guys who I think to some degree you certainly respect, or you actually have an affinity for hearing what they want to say. I like the idea that there's a place where guys who are in our business can hear other guys talk about what goes on in and around their world. And the other part, I'll tell you, you and any other program director who is that discernible listener, the guy who does tutor, the guy who tells you the truth with that foot in the rear end of the pat on the back, guys who love radio, really love radio. We need to have more of them in radio. And I do know that you're one of those guys. And it's not that you can hire me right now because you got some cockamamie consulting company or something. You're not even working for a radio station, so you're not doing me much any good. But at the end of the day, the more people who really love the format, the better off we're all going
to
be.
That's kind of you to say. I appreciate it. More importantly, though, I appreciate the time today. This has been a fascinating conversation. Really enjoyed going down memory lane with you. Continued success with 680 The Fan and The Rude Awakening, and you and I will catch up again off the air, having some more of these conversations soon.
All right, pal.
This is the Barrett Sports Media Podcast.
That was Chris Domino of 680 The Fan in Atlanta. Fascinating guy. One of the hardest working people I have ever been around in my entire career. I don't say that about a lot of people, but when you're doing 7 hours a day in two markets and clamoring for more, as Chris often does, that's a trait that you want to see out of any talent. And that's why, as a former boss of his, when I'm looking at personalities, the first thing that you've got to have beyond talent is work ethic. And when you've got talent and work ethic, you can do some incredible things. And that's why Chris Domino has now had two decades of success in a top 10 market. You know, one thing I want to touch on is how he immediately responded after going through one of the most difficult times of his career 3.5 years ago. Now, as I mentioned during the conversation, Chris, Nick Cellini, and Steak Shapiro were let go when they went through that nightmarish situation where they screwed up on the air with the bad bit centered around Steve Gleason. One thing Chris did right after that was he took to social media and he wrote one of the most heartfelt, sincere, genuine, real from the heart apologies. And I think this went a long way towards finding healing for a lot of folks, but also allowing him to express how remorseful he was given what had just transpired on his watch. And look, when you do 4 hours of radio a day, 5 days a week, and you've done it over 15 years, there's a good chance you're going to do something stupid or say something you didn't mean because it's live radio. You know, it's easy to focus on people and their 10 minutes of horror, but when you do this 240 minutes a day, 1,200 minutes a week, it's not unheard of to have a bad moment. What Chris wrote on social media was incredibly powerful. I want to share it with you. He said, "Where to begin? The obvious and rightful place is with an apology. And the reality of knowing that falls short, no matter what I say, is heartbreaking. The sheer stupidity of trying to put this as a failed attempt at humor is not lost on me. The words, should have known better, mean nothing to me, and shouldn't to you. I would, though, like to offer my apology, knowing that it's everyone's right not to accept it. My apologies go out first to Steve Gleason and his family. The weight of what he and they are going through did not need to be made heavier or worse by the pure and straight insensitivity of my actions. As a father of two girls, I put myself in a position that I have begged, pleaded, demanded they not put themselves in. That of the bully, the mean kid, the one who thinks what they say or do comes with no consequence. It does. It always does. I have no illusion as to what 19 years on the radio, 30 years of being a grown man, and almost 10 years of being a father, and what you build up in your name and reputation over those periods of time should and does mean. Now I know how quickly a stupid and worse than that non-thinking moment can change all of it. I hope I get a chance to prove this is not who I want to be. It was and is who I am today, though. That much is not lost on me. I've spent so long not trying to put other people in a bad place because of me. Today, I failed miserably." That was 44 months ago, and when Chris was offering advice of how to handle a situation if it ever unfortunately happens on your watch, let me tell you, if there was a book on how to write the perfect apology after a terrible incident, which ultimately cost you your career, that's it. And the reason why it worked is not because Chris went to the dictionary and put a bunch of fancy words together. It's because it was honest, from the heart, real. And when people sense that you make a mistake, and you've had 19 years before that of nothing but treating people with respect, you're going to often earn a second chance. And then it's up to you to make the most of that second chance, which is exactly what Chris has done since returning to the air with 680 The Fan in Atlanta. That's going to do it for the third episode of the Barrett Sports Media Podcast. My thanks to Chris Domino for joining me. A big thanks to you for listening today. Don't forget, if you haven't done so already, please take a moment to subscribe and leave a review for the podcast on iTunes. Every little bit that you can do to help us spread the word, it's greatly appreciated. As Kid Rock would say, if it sounds good, you'll hear it. If it looks good, you'll see it. If it's marketed right, you'll buy it. But if it's real, you'll feel it. And that, my friends, is the challenge that awaits each and every one of you who are broadcasting on the airwaves today. Until next time, I'm Jason Barrett. Thanks for stopping by.
I'd say that was a pretty successful broadcast.
Thank you for listening to the Barrett Sports Media Podcast. To stay updated on the latest sports media news, follow Jason on Twitter at SportsRadioPD and visit our website, sportsradiopd.com.